All right. Hello, everyone. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors and colleagues on this study, Haley Weintraub, Ben Henwood, Eric Rice, Taylor Harris, and Suzanne Wenzel, several of whom are here at APHA, but three are presenting at the exact same time, so they're not here. Interesting. I do not have anything to disclose. So I am going to talk about technology use among homeless adults today, and just a little bit of background about why this is interesting and what we know about technology use. Some recent systematic reviews have found really widely varying rates of cell phone and internet access among homeless populations. In exploratory research, homeless persons have reported that their cell phones are really important sources of safety, of responsibility, so for things like job searches and housing, talking to service providers, and also really important sources of social connectedness, so being able to maintain contact with friends and family. Technology is also a really important way for us to do health interventions with homeless populations. There are some recent really successful pilot programs that have used things like text message appointment reminders with homeless vets, automated cell phone calls to help improve medication adherence. And in some qualitative research by McInnes, who's done a lot of this research on technology use among homeless populations, found actually 90% of homeless vets had cell phones, used them to contact service providers, and this population was really receptive to using text messaging as a way to get appointment reminders, to be told about prescription refills, to improve medication adherence, and then also maybe as a way to find out about things like lab results or other test results. Definitely there are still potential limitations to using cell phones in homeless populations. We know that people have a desire to use them, but there are cost issues. And with any technology, there are concerns about how people actually use it. Not everyone is very tech savvy. So the data that I'm talking about today comes from a larger study that we're calling the Transitions to Housing Study. We're doing this in Los Angeles, and it's a longitudinal study of homeless adults moving into permanent supportive housing. What I'm talking about today all comes from our baseline interviews that are done prior to people moving into permanent supportive housing, and then we are following people. So we do the next interview at 3 months, then at 6 months, and at 1 year after they move into housing. Technology use is actually not a primary aim of this study. Really, this study is trying to understand in a holistic way how homeless adults' lives change when they move into permanent housing. And that's health, that's social relationships, that's risk behavior. And our goal is to use those findings to inform programs to help people stay in housing in the long term, reduce their risk behavior when they're housed, and improve their health and well-being over the long term. So the way that we actually have found people is we've partnered with 24 community-based organizations in the Los Angeles area. They refer, hopefully, all of the people moving into housing during our referral period who are eligible. Eligible people do have to be 40 years old or older. They need to be moving into permanent supportive housing within the next 3 months and moving in not with dependent children. So this really is about single adults, not families. And they need to be moving into about 15 to 20 miles of downtown Los Angeles. So most of our providers are in the Skid Row area of LA, but we also are within about 20 miles of that region. Participants do get paid for their time. We do interviewer-administered interviews in either English or Spanish. They're very intensive, hour and a half to 2 hour long interviews. And then our interviewers maintain contact with people monthly or more frequently to make sure that they stay in the study over their 1 year follow-up. Today I'm going to be presenting on data that's about 2 weeks old with our 436 baseline participants. Just this past Friday, we finally closed our baseline recruitment after 14 months of recruitment. 454 people, yay! But our longitudinal interviews will continue on for at least the next year. Because our baseline people do have 3 months to move into housing, it'll be a little more than a year before we're done. So maybe not next year, but APHA the year after, I'll have some true longitudinal findings for you. As I said, really long, intensive interviews that we do. I'm going to talk just about some selected measures today. So demographics, homelessness history, technology use, obviously, health and mental health, medication adherence, sexual risk behavior, substance use, service utilization, and then stuff from our social network interview. That actually sounds like a really long list when I read it out loud, but it is just a subset of our variables. So who are the people in this study? One of our eligibility criteria, as I said, is being 40 years old or older, so they're potentially a little bit older than the general population of people moving into permanent supportive housing at almost 55 years old. 73% are male, about 3.5% identified as transgender female, and the rest of our population is female. We are mostly black in this population, 54%, followed by 20% white, 18% Hispanic, and then other race or ethnicity identification. About 78% had completed high school. Monthly income was relatively high at $632 a month on average. Almost 11% had a foster care history. Almost 32% were military veterans. This is higher than the general housed popular people moving into permanent supportive housing, in part because LA right now is going through what we're calling a surge to get homeless vets housed. So there is an overrepresentation of veterans in our population. In the past 3 months before moving into housing, about 77% have been literally homeless, and the average lifetime years of literal homelessness in this population is about 6 years. This here is illustrating where people were staying when we interviewed them at baseline, so before they move into permanent housing. Most are staying in an emergency shelter, that's 40%, followed by transitional living programs at about 21%, then outside or other literal homelessness, here at 17 and 9%, make up a pretty big sample of people. So there's a fair amount of people in our study who are moving directly from the streets into permanent housing, which is good from a housing first perspective. Or from emergency shelter directly into housing. All good. Current cell phones. Really high proportion of people in our study have cell phones. 96% right now, 97% at some point in the past 3 months. Fair amount of them have had multiple cell phone numbers, or multiple phones, 45%, and then multiple phone numbers, 43%, had at least two. Almost 20% had three or more phone numbers over the past 3 months. Looking at just those people who currently have cell phones, 62% had smartphones, so a phone that they could also access the internet on, which is pretty high. And then among those with smartphones, overwhelmingly people had phones that operated on an Android operating system. So what are people doing on their cell phones? In addition to talking, they're texting. Almost 80% of people report sending or receiving text messages on their cell phones. 54% report using the internet. And 41% report accessing email on their phones. When we asked not just on their phone, but in general, did you use the internet in the past 3 months, almost 70% said yes, and 39% used the internet every day. So there's a lot of technology access in this group. Switching tasks slightly, what about health and risk behavior in this population? We use that very general global, how do you feel your health is, and good health or excellent health was reported by 44% of our sample. We use a primary care screener for PTSD symptoms. That's a 0 to 4 scale. People averaged about 2.3 out of 4 points on PTSD symptoms. We use the modified Colorado symptom inventory to assess symptoms of mental health disorders. That goes from 0 to 56 points, 56 being higher levels of symptoms. People average about 21 points on that. In terms of whether they have past 3 months unmet need for services, the average was only one service that they were not receiving that they needed in the past 3 months. And then I also assessed medication we assessed medication non-adherence. So if you have a current prescription for a physical health medication, are you taking it the way that you're supposed to? About 35% said no. And then if you have a current prescription for a mental or emotional health prescription, about 44% of those people said, no, I'm not taking that the way that I'm supposed to. Sex risk, relatively low in this population. 10% had multiple sex partners in the past 3 months, 6% reported exchange sex, and any unprotected sex was reported by about 26% of the sample. Only 45% of the sample was having any sex in the past 3 months, and this is out of our total sample, not that subsample. Substance use, also lower than we would have expected. About 17% report past 3 month binge drinking, 20% any hard drug use, so that's cocaine, crack, meth, heroin. And then injection drug use by about 3%. I'm sorry. Exchange sex, so it could be prostitution. It's exchanging sex, but it doesn't have to be for money. It can be for drugs, a place to stay, anything. So we do something called a social network interview with everyone in our study, where we sit down and we ask them to tell us who are all of the people that you have talked to or spent time with in the past 3 months. And we get this very exhaustive list of people about which we ask how they've communicated with these people, who these people are, characteristics of their relationships. I think I use the term later in the presentation, social network alter. So just so when I say alter, I just mean someone you said you communicated with in the past 3 months, someone who's in your social network. So I wanted to look at what percentage of people in our sample at baseline actually identify a service provider as a social network alter. So here we see about 65% said a case manager is someone I'm actively in contact with. 33% identified at least one counselor or therapist. And 28% identified some sort of physical health provider. Then in terms of, do you have anyone in your network who provides you with what I'm calling emotional or tangible support? So that's someone you said you could confide in, someone who gives you advice, or someone who, if you really needed it, would give you $100. 97.5% of people had at least one person like that in their network. How are people talking to these people in their network? Well, phone, 97% talk to at least someone by phone, 66% by text, 30% via email, and almost 20% via some other type of social media, so maybe Facebook or something else online. And then those rates don't really change when I restrict that to look at just those people who are supportive alters, who are providing some sort of support. Communication rates stay relatively stable in that group. What about how you communicate with service providers? Are you talking on the phone with them? Are you texting with them? Or are you only seeing them in person? I found that if you look at just case managers, about 78% do talk to their case managers on the phone in the past 3 months. 23% exchange text messages with case managers, 15% emails, and only about 2.5% communicate with them via social media. Counselors and therapists, rates are a little bit lower, but similar, 65% by phone, 20% by text, and then lower rates. Physical health providers were a little lower, only about 50% reported talking to a physical health provider by phone, less than 10% by text, and you can see the others up there. What I got really interested in here in thinking about this is the ways that communicating with a service provider using your cell phone or texting or email or social media really opens up a way to get the services that you need, to not have to actually show up, to not only see them when you have an appointment. Seems like it could be an excellent resource for people. So I created these indicators of whether you had any communication with a case manager, a therapist, or a physical health provider remotely. So that's by phone, text, email, or social media. Did you report in the past 3 months that you talked to any of those people by any of those ways? And 56% of our sample had. Then I wanted to limit that just to digital contact. So what are things that you're not picking up the phone, but you're actually doing something a little bit more technologically savvy? You're texting with them, or you're emailing, or you're using social media. And about 22% of our sample reported communicating with service providers in that way. Were there gaps? Are there certain types of people who are communicating with service providers remotely or via digital contact? I ran some logistic regressions looking at the associations with demographic characteristics. Remote contact only. That is less likely if you are older, and it's actually less likely among female respondents in our sample. Then when we move just to digital contact, again, less likely. The older you are, the less likely you are to communicate with service providers in this way. More likely if you have a high school education. And interestingly, more likely among those who had past 3 month literal homelessness experiences. So then the next question, at least in my mind, where I went down this route was, well, does communicating with service providers in this way improve your personal health and risk behavior outcomes? So I looked at logistic regressions assessing the associations between either what I termed remote contact, thank you, digital contact, and then all of those health and risk behavior variables that I presented to you earlier. I got a lot of null results. So I always tell my students, make sure you present null results. This is a really important part of research ethics. And then you see them and you go, oh, sad, I don't want to have to. Here I am. So among all of those health outcomes, I only found a couple of things that were associated with remote or digital contact with service providers. And they were not in the direction that I had anticipated. What I found was that remote contact was associated with having higher levels of PTSD symptoms and with those who reported hard drug use, so really more vulnerable populations. Similarly, when I look at just digital contact, those PTSD symptoms, those people who are actively having PTSD symptoms, more likely to have digital contact with service providers, and then also people who were non-adherent to their emotional or mental health medications. Before I talk about some of the conclusions and implications of these, I want to address some important limitations. I am only talking about our baseline data, which means this is cross-sectional. Causality is not something that I can assess at this point. We also have self-reported data only. When I'm talking about communication with service providers, it would be so interesting to know from the service provider's perspective what's going on. Also, only LA County. We're kind of a unique special bird in LA, and this may not be relevant to other parts of the country or to other countries. And also, for a variety of reasons, we're limited to adults, to people over the age of 40. And we know that technology use is very different among young people. So transitional age youth moving into permanent housing may have a very different experience with their technology use. So conclusion number one, which I think we already knew, but more evidence of it. Cell phones and technological communication are really important for homeless adults, and they're really important for homeless adults about to move into permanent supportive housing. This is a time of a lot of transition and upheaval, and a time when things, at least in the Los Angeles context, things can change really fast. You might be waiting on housing authority for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then all of a sudden you get your approval and you can move in the next day. You need to be able to have contact with your case manager or the housing agency. Cell phones are a really great way to do that because they are so prevalent, and the people in our study are reporting that it's a primary way that they communicate with the people in their lives. So phone, texting, email, social media access, these are all ways that people are maintaining contact with service providers, also with social relationships. We know that transitioning to housing can be a time when you might lose your social relationships or they might undergo some changes. So making sure that people have continued access to cell phones during that time could be really helpful in helping them maintain those relationships. However, we have a high turnover of phone numbers. So something that we need to be really coherent about is the ways that that might make it difficult to maintain contact over time. Also, I think phones are going to be and they are currently an excellent way and are going to become even more useful for disseminating health interventions, for research practices. I have only 1 minute, so I'm going to speed up. High levels of phone access. If you do want to do research or health interventions and things that are going to use applications, do it on an Android operating system. Don't design iPhone applications for this population. Nobody is using Apple systems. Many respondents are having phone, text, email, or social media contact with providers, but there are some important people being left out, older adults, female respondents. This question in bold is not something I can answer, but something that I want us as service providers, as researchers, to be thinking about. How do we ensure equitable access to cell phones? They're a really important resource for this population. What's going on with health outcomes and access to service providers? This is something that I'm really hoping that I can look at in the longitudinal data over time and try to parse out what's going on that more vulnerable, high-risk people are those people who are accessing their service providers via phone and digital contact. Thank you to all the people doing research in this area. Thank you to my amazing study colleagues, amazing interviewers, participants who shared their stories and their time, and our agency partners.